world. I mean, Margaret Atwood, she writes dystopias. I mean, this is just a story.
Well, I don't know. I think it is kind of... I think what makes it dystopic is the whole dark times, you know? Mm-hmm. That period where things must have been apocalyptic.
The dark times were a time when three perfectly normal disasters came about at a time when there were enough people in financial margins that they didn't have any extra room to adapt and change. But a lot of it is based off of the Great Wave, and he took in the concept of economic price changes and how they always built up to these impressive, you know, sultanic, few people have money and they change all the policies and you get these feudal lords and then suddenly this crash happens. And one of them happened after the Black Plague, and so I took that in. So we had a plague and a famine and an extra plague, which I threw in with genetic modification. And those all three happened at once. And as a result, they ended up losing a third of the population of the Earth. And they've been slowly building it back up again over a generation. And that's when Rose wakes up, is when that generation has just started to be functional again.
I guess without giving away any spoilers as to why she was in stasis for that long, and I assume I'm pronouncing it correctly, she was habitually in stasis.
Yes.
And it was something that her parents did. Mm-hmm. And to me, it slowly unravels that, you know, they were very abusive to her.
Oh, yes. I did a lot of research on abuse victims and mild dissociative disorders with Rose. She has the kind of dissociative disorder that just puts thoughts away. I'm not going to think about that right now, that the whole Scarlett O'Hara, I'll think about that tomorrow. She just never gets around to thinking about it. I had to focus on physical, emotional, and in fact sexual abuse, because the abuse was so quiet and so soft and didn't hurt, so she didn't think of it as abuse. But it affected her life and it affected her psyche. And so she became very passive. That's actually one of the complaints that people have who don't finish the book, is that how passive Rose is. Like, she's just an awful passive heroine. I can't bear reading it. You can be strong without being the badass who's going to grab, you know, the sword and hit somebody. You can be a strong person. In fact, you can even be a strong person if you are a passive person. And one of the passive heroines that I didn't like was this concept that's the best way of being a girl. And the way in which people become that passive is never a pretty picture. So I figured I'd paint that and let people see what it is that causes that.
You're listening to Stage and Studio. I'm Dee Mae Roberts, talking with author Anna Sheehan about her debut novel, A Long, Long Sleep. You can learn more about her at AnnaSheehan.com or stageandstudio.org, where you can hear this interview again. Sheehan's book centers around a young girl named Rosalinda who wakes up after being put in a stasis sleep by her parents for 62 years. Here, Sheehan reads an opening passage from her book.
It's a game I would play, trying to keep track of those misty images that were always so easily lost. I'd try to keep myself in stasis, keep my heart beating too slow to feel, refuse to wake up my lungs. Once or twice I managed to hold on so long that Mom panicked and turned on the resuscitator. So when the electric blue seascape I was trying to hold on to was interrupted, not by a hand, but by the feeling of lips on mine, I was startled. I sucked in a breath through my nose and sat bolt upright, knocking my head against my supposed rescuer. I couldn't see. Everything was dark and painful, as if I had just opened my eyes into a bright light after days in the dark. An unfamiliar voice shouted unfamiliar words. Holy quit, you are alive! I felt utterly lost. All I could do was grope for what I knew. Where's Mom? My voice wasn't mine. It sounded like a croak. I tried to take stock of condition. My muscles ached, and my lungs seemed filled with fluid. I coughed, trying to force air into the dormant passages. I tried to get to my feet. Piercing pains like knives shot through my legs and arms where I tried to lift myself. My very bones ached. I slid back down into the smooth, soft cushion of the stasis tube. Whoa! My rescuer leaped toward me as I fell. Warm hands grabbed at me, and my muscles screamed with stiffness. Don't touch me! I gasped. I didn't understand why I was in such pain. He let me go, but the pain didn't diminish. Coit, you scared me. The voice sounded overly excited. You weren't breathing there. I was afraid I'd botched the system and X'd you. I barely understood half of what he was saying. How long? I whispered. You only seemed dead for a minute, he said, as if to reassure me. I'd meant how long I'd been in stasis, but I abandoned that line of thought. It didn't matter. I told myself that every time I woke up. It didn't matter.
So her parents really did rob her of life.
Yes.
You know, because they would just put her to sleep whenever they had to go on a trip.
Mm-hmm. They did that constantly. They were basically keeping her a child. And there are other ways of doing that besides stasis. They just had a very convenient method.
Why do you think they did that?
I can tell you why. Her father was a sociopath and her mother was a narcissist. They didn't care. Diagnosing your characters is really great for villains.
So they basically just wanted to have a child, but they didn't really want her to grow up.
Her mother wanted an accessory. She really liked dressing her in, you know, matching clothes and keep, like these people keep little chihuahuas and dress them up and keep them in their purses. She really wanted a child to be like that. Her father, first off, didn't care much, but secondly, he wanted to make sure that the picture that they had was of a perfect family. And that was the public picture that they had. Other than that, he didn't care.
Yeah, that's really sad. I mean, on the surface, it seems like, oh, you know, for her, oh, this is just my life. In order to survive, she really didn't have to analyze it very much.
No, she had to suppress it. She had to go passive. It was a survival mechanism, her going passive. Because if she did any kind of argument, any kind of standing up for her rights, they just would immediately stase her.
And Xavier, you know, grew up with this too. Mm-hmm. And he had a hard time dealing with it because, you know, he knew it wasn't normal.
He knew it wasn't normal. There's one point in there where he says, do you think we should tell anybody? But at this time in this story, there are no laws against this because stasis is such a new technology. By the time Rose wakes up, it has been written down as, yeah, this is not a good thing to do, particularly to children. You have to really, you know, go through channels to see whether or not you are allowed to put your children into stasis, and usually only when, you know, they're sick or something. And for Rose, it was just normal life as far as she was concerned, and it totally robbed her of years of her life.
Sometimes society takes a while to catch up to the actual abuse that's happening.
Sometimes it's the abuse. Sometimes it's the genetic modification. There's a lot of things that I have. There's a line in there where I think Bren says, sometimes I think technology's messing with us. It has definitely messed with you. And in some cases, I think that can be true. And we need to keep an eye on what happens. At the same time, I'm not a Luddite. You know, things change and things should change in many cases. But you need to pay attention to what's real.
But I also think that anybody who survives abuse is a survivor, and it takes a certain amount of strength and resilience to be a survivor.
It does. And I grew up in a lot of LD and ED classes, emotional and educational disabilities. And the thing that you find out when you're in classes like that is just everybody has a diagnosis. And a lot of those people were abuse victims. So I ended up with a lot of my friends during my childhood being abuse victims of one kind or another. And they're some of the most interesting people. And yes, they are damaged. And sometimes it is very hard for them to, you know, become productive and get out of whatever rut they are in. But they have the most interesting stories and the most beautiful hearts.
So they recognize themselves in the character of Rose?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And in Otto and in Xavier. Xavier, who is watching this abuse and doesn't know what to do. I guess in terms of behavior, I was more like Xavier as a child or a teenager, because I was watching this happen to my friends. And there really isn't much that you can do in many cases, because, you know, calling the authorities, unless it's massive abuse, it's not going to do much good.
Well, Xavier is her child-long friend and mm-hmm. her first love.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, he is.
And Otto is an interesting character, too, because he doesn't follow the traditional route of what an alien is supposed to be like. But he is an alien on this world, isn't he?
He is an alien. He's part alien. What he is he's built this genetic modification thing that they do all over the place. Is they're making, you know, goats that give out spider silk and glow-in-the-dark cats. So you take a little bit of DNA from one thing and put it into another thing. And what they did was they took DNA from a microbe from Europa, which is another one of the moons of Jupiter, where they think there might be a liquid ocean underneath the ice. And they took this DNA from this microbe and put it into a human DNA. And it resulted in him just not being quite human. Some of it's physical, a lot of it's mental. Some of it is the way in which his system works, which is this electro-communication thing, which I'm not going to get into. It's really complicated in the book.
Well, he kind of, it's beyond mind reading, but it's sort of like mind reading, but beyond that, like he gets right into people's psyche somehow. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was fascinating in that, you know, you're dealing with GMO, but it's also just the moral rights of creating mm-hmm. another sentient being. Because he isn't really human, and yet, you know, he has human traits to him.
Well, I guess as an author, one of the things that you do is you get these characters and you get into their heads and then you change their psyches. And it's kind of Otto's kind of like this internal author. He can get into other people's heads and make them think or listen to how they're thinking. Mostly he listens.
So it was a nice device for you, too, as a writer.
It was kind of an accident. Otto showed up. He was not in the original treatment when I wrote out the synopsis. He showed up during that lunch period where he first shows up, and then he didn't say anything. And I asked a question, so why didn't that particular character say anything? And then he just blew up from there. And he solved a lot of problems in the book once it was started. So.
Well, I like how you captured the world of these teenagers, because they're mostly young people and they have these adults around them that affect their lives. And the high school, when Rose first wakes up, they just immediately put her into high school like a couple weeks later. It's like, whoa, you know, high school 65 years later. And there's this slang. It's like everybody speaks differently. And I sometimes hear slang and I go, that sounds kind of cheesy. But this actually seemed like it would be slang in this world.
Well, some of it is from slang from when I was a kid. The sped thing was my friend Bethany called everybody, "You're such a sped." So that ended up just being carried up. Sky was something that happened kind of accidentally. People would ask, you know, "What's up?" And I'd say, "The sky." And it just kind of turned into something. Com is communicate, short for communicate. That one I just came up with. Burn it and coit, both of those were replacements for swear words. Burn it came probably from the dark times when they were burning things to get rid of infection. But the actual function of those particular versions of slang was that I wanted to use swear words, and I actually wanted the book to not get banned in middle schools, because a lot of them don't allow books with actual swear words in them. So teenagers use swear words. They just do. So in order to have the kind of interactions and communication that those kids would actually be having, I had to replace the swear words with something else. In Red Dwarf, they did it with smeg. You know, in Battlestar Galactica, they used frack, so I came up with my own.
Getting back to how you created Rose or Rosalinda and some of the other characters, they all have some kind of mental disorder or some kind of, not all of them, but several of them, like Otto and
Guillory.
He's definitely an alcoholic, but
oh, yeah.
You know, but you deal with some of these issues. I don't want to say, you know, addiction and mental ability.
Well, everybody has something with them that you can give a name to. And it actually does help with creating a character to give an underlying reason behind varying behaviors, particularly villains. Villains are wonderful to diagnose. But it has less to do with the concept of everybody has something wrong with them than the fact that everybody is different and you can always give a name to that thing, whatever it is.
You mentioned that readers have related to these.
They have. They don't always know what they're looking at, particularly Rose. A lot of abuse victims have contacted me and sent me letters saying, you know, "You've really, really reminded me of something, or really, really touched on something that I haven't heard other people say." The concept of abuse being quiet and not really recognizing that that's what it is something that touches a lot of people who, I guess, have felt alone and abandoned in this concept of, well, abuse has to be, you know, penetration or beating ups, or, you know, there's just a lot of different kinds of abuse.
Are your readers of all ages?
They have been, yes. I've had anybody who's cognizant enough to read through the whole book, so I guess anybody over the age of 11. But I've had fans who've shown up who are like, you know, 50-year-old men. I think they're connecting with varying different characters. It was intended as a feminist or girl's science fiction, which is, I don't know how regular that is, but when I first started writing, such a thing was, you know, unheard of. Nowadays with the Hunger Games and the varying paranormal romances, these girls who are protagonists in science fiction style stories are more common. When I started writing, that was not the case.
And I also liked that there was a lot of multiracial characters in the book, too.
I did that intentionally. In fact, I had to fight my editor to keep it, because she's like, "Well, it just seems too intentionally diverse." I was like, "Well, you got to understand, these kids are actually all from the same strata of society." So I made this kind of royal court, and the royal court would have to come from different areas. So you'd have to have somebody from Germany, you'd have to have somebody from New Russia, you'd have to have somebody from just Europa where they are. And so in order to get the top of anything, you'd end up getting a huge diversity of different backgrounds and races, but they'd still all be the king, the prince, the duchess, or the modern equivalent or futuristic equivalent thereof.
So to get a good mixture of different folks is to improve the bloodline too.
I guess. I never thought about that. It was the uni prep, this high school, is kind of based slightly off of Eton or, you know, some of these other various really impressive private schools that really, really rich people send their kids to. I did have to fight my editor to say, look, I'm allowed to say that this person is from Africa. I'm allowed to say that this person is Eurasian. I'm allowed to say that these people have race, because that's what people see. It's not that I'm being racist. It's that this is, people see race. It does not mean that makes them any less or more. It's just that that's, you know, where they came from, their heritage. And in many cases, you can see that. In many cases, you can't.
I'm sorry that you had to fight your editor on that, but I'm
glad. She was a sweetheart. She was really, really supportive.
I'm glad you did, though. But I think that's not unusual. I think a lot of people say, well, you want this to sell, so it's got to appeal to a strictly white audience. Let's hope that that is changing for your sequel. So how is that going?
Oh, boy. The sequel was written. My partner of 7 years, the father of my 9-year-old daughter, died immediately after I sold the book. Before it had gotten published. And the sequel, when it was written, I think ended up with a lot of grief in it. It was a little darker than the first book. But, you know, the first book's pretty dark. It doesn't have a happy ever after. It's kind of bittersweet. It ends with strength, but not necessarily, you know, everything solved. And the second book is much the same. And it bothered my editor, I think, and my agent, for that matter. And it bothered a lot of people. I think it even bothered my sister, that it, exactly the level of darkness that was in it. But it ended, hopefully, I thought. So I tried to do a bunch of changes that they asked for. Couldn't end up making the book work with them. So I'm actually in the process now of putting the book back the way it was, or at least close enough to back the way it was. But it's taken years to get it that direction.
You mean to back the way it was with originally when it was darker?
Yeah, I had a character who went crazy, and my editor decided that him going mad was just too difficult for teenagers to understand. A lot of teenagers end up in psych wards. A lot of teenagers end up being diagnosed as crazy. I really don't think it's beyond anybody's ability to grasp.
I think you're right, and I think you should go with your gut, because I think just based on a lot of, you know, TV shows that I've seen and films that I've seen, and just the type of material that is in young adult fiction now, I think that actually might be a plus now.
I don't know. It's a complex story. They try to dumb down YA sometimes, but that's not to say that the editors weren't right about a lot of the changes that they wanted to make in the first book. So that's why I tried to make the changes. I really tried to be a good little debut author and listen to my editor and do things the way that I should. And I still have kept a lot of the changes that they requested from the sequel. It's just that the plot was not working with some of them, so I'm putting it back.
Yeah, I think that it's always good to try to make those changes, though. So it's good. It's and so you think you're going to be coming out with it anytime in the next soon?
The book is in 8 countries, and the American publisher has currently put it on the back burner. The British publisher says that they'll publish it sometime in the next year, but since they haven't even looked at the final edit yet, I don't exactly know how that works. The publishing industry is at a glacial pace at this point. The people who are doing self-publishing are getting their stuff out in 6 months, and the publishing industry has not caught up to that.
So do you have music that goes with your book at all?
Not this one. I think Otto wrote some poems for the next book. I haven't written any actual things.
Why did you start playing the harp?
I started playing the harp when I was 16. I got my harp when I was 13. Started playing it because I love music. My whole family plays music a little bit. None of us are professionals. My father plays music at the bar at the Howling Dog Saloon up in Fairbanks, and he's got a little guitar. But you know, I just loved the sound of the harp. It was one of the few instruments I could bear to listen to myself learn how to play. You know, you play something else. You play a fiddle wrong, and it sounds like a screeching cat, but you play a harp wrong. I mean, you drop it on the floor, it sounds good.
Well, would you like to introduce me to your harp again and maybe play a song for us?
Out? This is my 22-string harp. Her name is Maud. You have to name a harp, otherwise it doesn't really have a good soul. At least that's what the ancient Celts used to think.
Was author Anna Sheehan talking about her debut novel, A Long, Long Sleep. You can learn more about her at Anna Sheehan, SHEEHAN.com. That's it for Stage and Studio. You can hear this show again at stageandstudio.org, as well as the podcast on iTunes. Also like us on facebook.com/stage_nstudio or tweet me at @StageNStudio. Till next time, I'm Dee Mae Roberts. We're going out with more music by Anna Sheehan.
Cebu Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the JHS Annual Multicultural Film Festival's presentation of Two Americans. This documentary considers the status of undocumented immigrants in light of Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio's civil rights violations. This showing of Two Americans will be facilitated by Mr. Freddy Trujillo, who will lead the discussion following the movie. Two Americans will be shown at the North Portland Neighborhood Library at 512 North Killingsworth, on Tuesday, April 8th, starting at 6 p.m. More information on this event can be found online at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio 90.7. Stay tuned for Art Focus with host Ava Lake at 11:30.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Ava Lake. Thanks so much for listening to Art Focus. I have with me today two artists who are showing together at Waterstone Gallery. I have with me today Grace Weston, who's an old pal of mine, I must confess. And I have with me Lisa Kaser, who she's the one who actually invited Grace to do this exhibition at Waterstone Gallery. So Waterstone Gallery, that's in the Pearl. That's on 12th. Yes.
12th near Gleason.
12th near Gleason. And the name of the show is called Unfamiliar Faces. How did we get to that name? And I guess one thing I also wanted to know is the whole idea of inviting another artist to show with you. Is that an unusual thing with Waterstone, or is that like just your idea? What happened, Lisa?
Well, it's really up to the artist member. Waterstone is a cooperative gallery.
Okay.
We have 17 current members, and we have a calendar that about every year and a half to 2 years, we have an opportunity to show. So we can design that show however we choose. So we can have a one-person show.
Mm-hmm.
We can invite a guest artist. We can curate a show. We basically have the control of what we want to happen that month that we have on the calendar. So as far as inviting Grace, this would be considered my first solo show, my first opportunity to have that responsibility of choosing or
and
not.
And you're so generous with your solo show.
Well, I had kind of lofty ideas initially because I had 2+ years out to plan this. Uh-huh. But I had other shows that were happening in other galleries that it wasn't like I could focus, you know, exclusively on give myself 2 complete
years. You're a busy
years.
Gal is what you're telling us. You're showing all, where else were you showing? Just
I show at Simon Mace in Port Townsend, Washington.
Uh-huh.
And I had a show not that long ago, in the fall of this last year. And then I'm represented by Brumfield Gallery in Boise,
mm-hmm.
Idaho. And so I had a fairly heavy schedule, sculptural work. And that's the most time consuming of the work that I do. So I was spacing it out. And I was basing this April show on those other obligations. So... Mm-hmm. Grace and I, though, have talked a lot about, just because we've been friends and we're familiar with our work, and we have tossed around that idea, and I tossed around that idea with her a while back, but I wasn't sure if I was going to relinquish that opportunity to have a solo show. Right. I wasn't quite sure, but mm-hmm. as time neared, things had not really solidified for me, and I realized she had this great body of work that was underway and that was pretty well complete. I had a pretty good sense that you had shot a lot of work, and it just, we were having a conversation and I just knew I had to ask her if I was going to ask her.
Right.
So I asked her this last fall to share the show.
Mm-hmm. So Unfamiliar Faces is, it's about people we don't know or about situations we don't know. What does that mean?
Well, it's funny because we got on the phone, you know, after everything was underway as far as, you know, we were going to show together. And it came to the point where we had to come up with a title. And I wasn't really sure what Lisa's new work was looking like, but because I'm living in Seattle now, I hadn't seen the work. But I knew she had gone through a bit of a change with, you know, from her previous work. And I certainly had gone through a change with my work. And so we started tossing titles around, and Unfamiliar Faces came up. And it was very uncanny, actually, how it ended up really applying to
both of our
bodies of work. Yes.
Something I haven't done yet, and I think I probably should do at this point, is, all right, so 2 artists in this show, but different mediums. There's sculpture, which is on the wall, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That are characters of some sort. And then, and that's Lisa Kaser's work. Then there's Grace Weston's work, which is a grid of photographs that are... also, well, they're people, they're dolls, but that's all kind of ambiguous because everything's really smoky, soft focus, foggy. So in both cases with this work, it's like, who is this and what is this and what are they doing? Am I right about that?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. My work I called neo-noir, and as I've done previously, I'm working with miniature characters, but these are very extremely out of focus, nothing in focus at all in the picture, and a lot of just the impression of their environment. And I call it neo-noir because I started to notice that they seem very mysterious and like strangers. The characters are usually isolated. There's a lot of... mystery and not quite knowing what's going on, which mm-hmm. is what I liked. And,
you know, that's what I liked about it. And I really felt like it harkened to Pulp Fiction or neo-noir or 60s spy movies, you know. Mm-hmm. So,
well, so I think you're kind of, Grace, maybe known for, well, maybe more humor in your work. How about mm-hmm. that? And yes. also maybe more of a narrative, like, oh, look what they're doing.
Yes.
So this to me seemed really different because it's not so funny. I mean, maybe some images are, but I don't think that's the first thing we think of when we see the images.
No.
And also, again, the narration is really open-ended. It's not really, I don't think it's telling a story so much.
No.
Except for a few, maybe.
Right. I feel like a thread is suggested, but sort of the point of it is confusion, mystery, not knowing what's going on, feeling lost, you know, or not knowing who to trust. It has that kind of sense about it.
Mm-hmm. And we should mention Waterstone Gallery. Is it just waterstonegallery.com?
Yes.
Is that? Yes. Yeah. And also just real quickly, Artist Talk you guys are doing soon?
This Sunday. Coming Sunday at 11.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
At the gallery.
Right. Okay. So if you haven't got enough information today, you can go and get more. So just to kind of stick with these photos for a moment, you presented them small and in a grid. I love that approach, and I've certainly seen this with other photographers. Tell us why. What led you to doing it that way?
My previous work, I would mat with deep mats and the whole deal, and each piece is sort of presented and it's its own story. This work, because it did sort of fit together. I see it. There's 20 pieces in the show right now, and they're mm-hmm. set up as a grid, and they can be looked upon as though that grid is one piece,
mm-hmm.
or there can be individual pieces. And I didn't want any mats. I wanted them, it's full bleed, mounted on Sintra.
Sintra, right.
Yes.
And there's no glass in front of it or
no
anything
glass,
like that.
Yeah. And they have a little French cleat on the back, so they actually stand off the wall maybe half an mm-hmm. inch or something.
Mm-hmm.
And in that manner, they almost become